So here's the chain of events. Your kid gets the flu, then the kids in his class get sick, and then it spreads throughout the whole school, and then the school closes.
We want every parent to have, at a minimum, a backup child care plan to know if their child gets sick, who's going to be home and take care of that child.
Hello to you. I'm a babysitter.
She seems very nice, right? And she has lots of experience.
Of course she does. She's 200 years old. Sick day every day. I don't want to go to school. I don't want to go to work. Staying
home is really cool. Hey, hey. Staying home is really cool. Hey, hey. Who's going to pay for all the sick days and the child care? I'll give you one guess on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 2nd. Not a sick day. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. So besides a boom time for babysitters because of swine flu, we're going to be talking about President Obama stumping for Chicago to get the Olympics. We'll hear some of your strong opinions on texting while driving. We really struck a chord this week. And our movie review team helps make sure you don't throw money away on a bad film this weekend. Also, movie trivia. Stay tuned.
First, though, let's talk to Kathleen Murphy. Kathleen is a health services coordinator for the Milwaukee Public Schools. Kathleen, how bad is it in Milwaukee?
Well, right now, Celeste, it's very much on the quiet side, and we're grateful for that. School's been in session for a little bit over a month, and we haven't seen anywhere the kind of numbers that we did last spring.
And you had a couple deaths over the summer, correct?
We did, last spring and into the summer. And, of course, we closed 16 schools within a period of 2 weeks last spring. So
okay.
We're hoping this quiet trend holds until the vaccine's available.
Kathleen, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a few minutes. Right now, though, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, it's T-minus 4 hours and 30 minutes. The 2016 Summer Olympic pitches are over. Chicago, Rio, Tokyo, and Madrid await the decision of International Olympic Committee voters. On Capitol Hill, it took a marathon session, but the Senate Finance Committee has finished its health care bill. The committee chair declared it done around 2 a.m. D.C. time. The committee is expected to pass it into the full Senate next week.
The latest unemployment rate is out in less than 30 minutes. We'll bring it to you as soon as we get it. The current number is 9.7%. The CDC says H1N1, or swine flu, is now widespread across the country. The CDC is particularly concerned about deaths among pregnant women. States are now placing orders for the new H1N1 vaccine. And David Letterman says someone wanted $2 million from him to keep quiet about affairs with staffers. He admitted to the affairs on his show last night.
That'll
Letterman
show him.
Said he helped authorities run a sting operation. Well, you can't get blackmailed if everybody
That's right.
knows, right?
That's right.
A CBS employee is now charged in the case. On Wall Street, the number sunk more than 2% yesterday. That means the Dow opens next hour at 9509. The S&P will start trading at 10:30, and the NASDAQ begins at 20:57. So we're wondering how all this unemployment news is going to be affecting the holidays, because the news is out that places like Target and other retailers just aren't going to be hiring as many extra
seasonal
people.
Seasonal workers, the
yeah,
holiday
over
workers,
the holidays.
Right.
And the fact is a lot of people depend on that extra income in order to finance lots of presents
yep.
under the tree or
exactly.
many a Hanukkah presents. Are you changing plans? Are you cutting back because of restrictions or not getting hired through seasonal employment? Let us know. My take at thetakeaway.org, or post your thoughts at our website, thetakeaway.org.
When Reginald was home with flu, the doctor knew just what to do. He cured the infection with one small injection while Reginald uttered some interjections.
So you just heard about the CDC report saying there's already significant flu activity in every single state. John, what when your kids are sick, does your wife stay home with them?
Well, we've got various options, including a backup, as Kathleen Sebelius was suggesting there at the top. I also, you know, we're concerned about the injection. Tamiflu is being stockpiled, and we're in line to get Tamiflu in case kids start showing symptoms. We've got four kids, so we've got a lot of vectors in our house.
Well, for me, I'm the backup plan. I'm plan A, plan B, and you know, I'm a single parent. If my kid's home, I stay home with him for the most part. The government has been telling schools, please only close as a last resort, but there's already been 187 school closures since the school year started last month, and a report released Wednesday by the Brookings Institution says, get this, school closings could cost the nation $10 to $47 billion. Can we afford to get sick? That's really the question this morning. We're speaking to Kathleen Murphy. She's a health services coordinator for Milwaukee Public Schools. So, Kathleen, you were saying that you had a number of school closings earlier, last school year, right? But not yet this year.
Yes, we did. Last school year, last spring, when the epidemic was in full force, we closed approximately 16 schools within 2 weeks. And you're right, it was incredibly disruptive to folks. And, of course, going forward, that is not the new strategy that's been proposed by the CDC. If severity of disease gets much worse than it is now, there may be other options on the table. But currently, that's not the preferred option for managing disease transmission.
Well, in the Milwaukee Public Schools, you've got a lot of families that come from different socioeconomic backgrounds. So what kind of hardship does this put on families if a school closes?
Well, we really do. Approximately 75 to 80% of our children eat two meals a day at school. So right there, when schools close, there's an impact on their nutritional status and a family's ability to meet that child's need in that regard. We have children who are getting daily occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy. Of course, those services are not happening when schools close. And then on top of it, a parent's ability to care for their child if they're in a workplace that doesn't have a flexible sick leave or child care policy.
That's the question there. We're also joined by Ross Hammond from the Brookings Institute, co-author of this report, Economic Cost and Healthcare Workforce Effects of School Closures in the U.S., and also Dr. Fahim Yunus. He's an epidemiologist and a specialist in infection prevention. He joins us from Baltimore. So, Ross, you heard Kathleen mention the cost for parents, but you know, this really is an important thing. I mean, we're talking about a lot of people, 59 million American workers who don't get paid sick days.
That's right, Kathleen. And as Kathleen mentioned earlier, a lot of those workers do not get paid sick leave and may actually also rely on subsidized school meals and lots of other facilities that the school provides. So I think there are important reasons not to close schools. That doesn't mean that children who are sick shouldn't stay home, but it means that the school itself shouldn't close entirely.
So what are these costs? You talked about $10 to $47 billion overall across the nation. What kind of costs are in there?
Sure, that's a very big number, and that would be for closures across the entire United States. The numbers are generated in the following way. Of course, when schools close, then parents have to find a way to look after their kids. And in some households, there will be adults who can care for children without missing work, but in others, adults will have to miss work. And those missed work hours means less goods and services are produced in the economy, and that's a cost to the economy, to the gross domestic product. So what our study does is it gives careful projections of how much worker absenteeism school closures might produce, how many households will have to have a parent who misses work, and therefore how extensive those economic costs might be. So we do have this very large number for all U.S. schools for a four-week closure that's, as you say, $10 to $47 billion. But we also break down the cost per student so we can look at more discrete regional closures. So the cost per student turns out to be about $142 per student per week. So to give you an example, closing all New York City schools for 4 weeks could cost the economy about $1 billion.
You also said the value of the lost class time, Ross Hammond from the Brookings Institute, would be $6.1 billion.
Per week, yes, it could be. It could be across the entire U.S., and that's a fairly conservative estimate.
So we're also joined by Dr. Fahim Yunus, an epidemiologist. Doctor, you wrote in the Baltimore Sun that the CDC shouldn't be telling people to stay home. Why is that?
I think the real point here is that as we go deeper into this pandemic, the reality is going to kick in, that life for an average American in the left lane, people just like what Mr. Hammond and Ms. Murphy are saying, schools will have to remain open. People will have to go to work. Say, for example, more than 70% of the Americans, when polled, they said they will go to work if they were sick. Now, we have 59 million people without a paid sick day. Say 10% of them get the flu, and another 70% of that 10% end up going to work. That's more than 5 million people, potentially contagious folks out there. So all I'm saying is, as we get deeper into this pandemic, we will see people coughing and sneezing out there. And what is our plan to mitigate that?
Well, Dr. Yunus, you're an epidemiologist. And, the question really is, what tools do we have if people are going to go to work? Does Tamiflu, which is supposed to combat the viral load in the body. It's an antiviral drug, which is recommended if you start to show symptoms. Does that prevent contagion? Is that any way going to mitigate some of the things you're talking about if people do continue to work or go to school?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Tamiflu can be used as a prophylaxis. But once again, let's be practical. A five-day course of Tamiflu may cost more than $90. Mm. And for 46 million Americans without insurance, and how many times will you take that course? You'll have people sick around you every month, every week. The reality is we need to come up with a more practical solution. And therefore, vaccine as well. We know from certain studies that less than 50% or around 50% folks are likely to roll up their sleeves for this H1N1 vaccine, which we in the medical community feel that it's going to be an important tool in our arsenal to fight this battle. And just like we've been promoting hand washing, there are other barrier precautions, just using a face mask, which right now we just simply don't have that culture. I always talk to my colleagues and I ask them, when was the last time you were in an elevator with someone who was coughing and sneezing, or at coworkers in our cubicles, and we've seen that. But we normally don't see a scenario of people walking with a face mask if they're sick. And that's something, when you go to 2003 and look at how Hong Kong worked, though they learned a lot of lessons, but 76% of the people in Hong Kong were wearing a face mask in the midst of that outbreak.
So Kathleen Murphy, the health services coordinator for Milwaukee Public Schools, you heard us talking earlier about the value of the lost class time being in the billions across the nation. And I'm wondering, if a school closes, there are lots of schools that are now making sort of homeschooling options. Are the Milwaukee Public Schools trying to come up with options where the kids can do their homework and their classwork from home?
Absolutely. Milwaukee Public Schools has something we call SOFA School. That's available on the internet. And of course, we, like many urban school districts, have a digital divide with many of our children who may not have computers or internet access at home. And of course, if school's closed, we certainly don't want them congregating in other learning spaces like libraries and that sort of thing. But we do have a number of resources that are available online, and in addition to public television and that sort of thing. But the guidelines from the CDC and the Department of Education also recommend good old-fashioned homework packets, and that's one of the strategies that we're looking at. And in addition to that homework packet, we're looking at shelf-stable foodstuffs that we could package with the homework so that we can help mitigate some of that issue with children missing meals.
So, Ross Hammond of the Brookings Institution, you know, in conducting this report, do we know what it's cost so far, what the school closings we had at the end of last year and so far this school year have cost?
No, we haven't made a detailed estimate of that, but we do have these per student per week estimates that could allow some insight into that. There's a third point I just wanted to get into that is a very important result of our study, which is that some of these parents who have to stay home to care for kids will be healthcare workers. And we actually estimate this could amount to almost 20% of the healthcare workforce. And it's really not clear how the health system would continue to function very well with this many workers absent. So large-scale school closures have another cost, which is they could actually undermine other mitigation efforts, like the delivery of the vaccine or the treatment of the sick.
There was also an interesting Harvard study that more than many Americans said they'd probably lose their job if they stayed home for 7 to 10 days, and nearly 50% of them were minorities. Thanks to all of you. Ross Hammond is with the Brookings Institution. He's co-author of the report, The Economic Cost and Healthcare Workforce Effects of School Closures in the U.S. We also heard from Kathleen Murphy, RN and Health Services Coordinator for Milwaukee Public Schools, and Dr. Fahim Yunus, epidemiologist and a specialist in infection prevention.
And now some quick takeouts on stories we need to be on top of this week. We're going to start with Todd Zwillick, as we often do, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. So Max Baucus stayed up late, and that meant you did too, Todd Zwillick, right?
Yeah, that's right. Max Baucus dropped the gavel on the health care bill, John, at about 2:15.
Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. That's the sort of it's the opening salvo in the full Senate's treatment of the health care debate. What did they come up with in the Finance Committee?
Well, they're done with amendments now. The only thing left is to actually vote on this bill in committee, and that'll come next week. But all the amendments are done, and they made some really notable changes yesterday that could be a big deal when this reaches the floor. The one thing they passed was an amendment from Maria Cantwell, senator from Washington State, a Democrat. So they're calling it sort of a mini public option. And of course, they call it that because they want Democrats who are wavering to feel like this is a public option they can sort of glom onto. Basically, it says for lower middle income people, up to 200% of poverty, states can opt in and sort of make their own little public options just to cover these people, nobody else. So it's kind of a mini kind of weakened public option. And the only interesting, really interesting thing about that is, what about all these Democrats who said, I'll only vote for something if there's a public option? Will this be the political cover they need to say, okay, that's a public option, I can sign on? And they did a second thing, John, that was actually really important. And I didn't mean to bury the lead here, but They made some major moves on access and affordability in this bill. Basically, an amendment from Chuck Schumer and Olympia Snow exempts about 2 million people from the – you've heard of the individual mandate. You know, you've got to buy insurance or pay fee. Exempts about 2 million people from that, depending on their income. And it's kind of a big deal. Here's Chuck Schumer talking about his amendment.
In my state and many other – in every other state, making 60, 70, 80,000, they may have two kids in college – the small business that they run may have run into trouble, and it would be just wrong to put such a burden on them for the good of having insurance.
So this exempts a lot of those people sort of in the middle there
from having to buy coverage. Which means they'll be uninsured, though, right?
Oh, we're going to get to that. That's exactly the trade-off they're dealing with. Now, there's another part of this amendment, too. And this is sort of a handoff to Senator Olympia Snow, the Republican who all the Democrats want to support this bill. You got if you don't buy insurance under this bill, if you refuse, you got to pay a fee. You got to pay a fine or a tax, whatever you want to call it. In the first year now, nobody has to pay it. And they sort of really lowered the threshold for how much people have to pay, especially at the lower income scale. This was one for Senator Olympia Snow. Here's Olympia talking about it.
I don't want to see Congress imposing penalties on average Americans who are struggling, and certainly don't want to impose penalties for which they have zero to show for it.
So I ran to Olympia Snow after this to say, hey, are you on board? You know, does this mean you're supporting the bill? She said she's not there yet. She told me to characterize it as progress, but not major progress in her mind. Now, John, real quickly, you hit on the most important thing. This amendment really shows the tension between affordability and coverage, right? This is 2 million people who won't be covered now, and they're still going to get sick.
Right.
They're still going to go to the hospital,
and they
still need care.
A vote in the committee today, and we'll see if there are 60 votes in the full Senate. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
Now to sports with our sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. So there's some iconic rivalries in college football coming up this weekend, right?
Yes, definitely. For me personally, I played football at the University of Rhode Island. If we lost every other game in the season, but we beat Brown, then it was a successful season. They play this weekend at 12:30, so I'm looking to that one.
There's that's also a Division AA. That's not in the college polls. It's sort of
correct.
Second tier.
Division One AA.
Hey. It's not second tier to Ibrahim,
third
John.
Tier.
So there's a similar matchup this weekend. It played the University of California, Berkeley, Cal. They're the Bears, who last week lost big to Oregon. They dropped number 6 in the AP poll to number 25. No matter what happens in the season for Cal, if they manage to beat USC, the University of Southern California, who is ranked 7 in both the AP and the USA Today polls, they're a powerhouse football program led by Pete Carroll that's always in the hunt for the national championship. So this is the deal. Cal must beat USC this weekend, and I predict that they actually will. This is one of the premier matchups in college football and one that's well worth watching. And also in the Ivy League, the undefeated Cornell heads into a big test this weekend against undefeated Patriot League champion powerhouse Colgate. And that's a really interesting game. And then as rivalries go, we know we love rivalries.
This is a big one.
This is a big one. There's nothing like a battle for Michigan to get the blood boiling. It's undefeated. The undefeated Michigan Wolverines face a better than expected Michigan State team. And here is Michigan State Trojans head coach.
Spartans.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, exactly.
Spartans.
I'm sorry. I didn't want to.
Spartans.
Mark D'Antonio, and this is what he had to say about it.
It's a state rivalry, I think, is pretty well documented. This place is, this state is drawn either green or blue pretty much. And so there's a lot of people involved in this rivalry, and it's very exciting, I think, for everybody who's ever played in this.
So Michigan State is the green.
Right.
And the Michigan Wolverines are the
go blue.
Go blue. Go blue. And I expect Michigan to take this one in a nail biter because it's a rivalry game, so it's going to be close. And then there's also a big game with Oklahoma, an early favorite for the national championship. They're going to be going against Miami, who dropped down in the rankings last week after a tough loss to West Virginia. And here's what Oklahoma safety Sam Proctor had to say about that game.
Definitely trying to build on it. You know, shutouts against, you know, some worthy opponents, but Miami will be probably some of the best competition we've seen all year. So we'll really get to see where we're at.
Sounds like there's going to be a lot of people on their sofa with bowls of popcorn this
Miami
weekend.
Miami can surprise, though.
I agree. Sure. I think Miami's going to take this one. I think it's going to be they're going to redeem themselves after last week. And briefly, if we want to just say the Tigers lost last night, and they're up to the Minnesota Twins.
So it's still in play.
Exactly. So now it's two games, and it's three games left. The key
Central
thing,
Division.
Central Division.
Central Division.
Exactly.
Okay. Thanks to the Takeaway Sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
The Twins are still alive. Well, as always, our last takeout comes from you, our listeners. The hot topic this week was driving while distracted. You really responded to that. The U.S. Transportation Department said almost 6,000 deaths were connected to driver distraction. What did you say? Anthony from Watchung, New Jersey, emailed us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. There is a BlackBerry application called Color ID, which flashes a sequence of colors. I use this for important people who send messages. If it's cyan and purple, I know I need to check the message right away and look for a safe place to pull off and do so. Otherwise, I ignore it. Practical suggestions. Yesterday, someone suggested having GPS phones turn off when they detect fast movement, but Hesh emails us. Using the GPS in all phones is very clever, but that would mean that people on buses and trains would be blocked. It would also mean that passengers, even in taxis, would be affected. Too clever for its own good, that app. Shari emails us to say this about proposed laws. I was rear-ended by a cell phone user, and now I am disabled. I don't think that multitasking is beneficial to anyone, but you can't legislate common sense and caring about other people's safety.
Obama has his own solutions here. He signed an executive order saying federal employees will not be allowed to text while driving government-provided cars or conducting government's businesses. And separately, the federal government plans to ban text messaging by bus drivers and truckers who travel across state lines and may also preclude them actually from using cell phones while driving at all.
The issue of truckers was a big issue at that summit we were talking about earlier this week. Well, coming up, we're going to get the 2016 Olympics handicap. Is it Chicago? Is it Rio? Is it Tokyo? Is it Madrid? We'll talk more in just a few minutes. So coming up, will it be Rio or Chicago, maybe even Madrid or Tokyo? Who will get the 2016 Summer Olympics? We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. Right now, top stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Biggest economic indicators around is just out as of a couple of minutes ago. The current unemployment rate, 9.8%. That means payrolls declined by 263,000 in September, slightly more than expected. Previous rate was 9.7%. The health care overhaul bill in the Senate is now complete. Finance Chair Max Baucus declared it done around 2 a.m. this morning. The committee is expected to vote to the full Senate sometime next week.
Staying with health news, the CDC says it's worried about pregnant women with H1N1 or swine flu. Nearly 30 have died since the flu outbreak started. David Letterman says someone tried to blackmail him for $2 million last night on his show. He admitted to affairs with staffers. He said he told authorities after someone wanted money to keep the relationships quiet. A CBS employee is charged in the plot. Overseas, major nuclear talks with Iran are over. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So the Olympic horse trading is taking place right now. Joining us, Alex Capstick, BBC sports commentator for our partner in Copenhagen. So, Alex, it just comes down to a business deal. You really have to admire the IOC's sense of suspense.
It's a very tense and tight battle. I think the four bidding cities would say it's a little bit more than a business deal. Getting the Olympics, of course, is worth hundreds of millions of dollars in investment, lots of jobs. So these, and of course, the prestige of being on the centre of the global stage for those 2 weeks in 2016. We're halfway through the presentations. We're just looking at Rio's at the moment, a very detailed look at their bid plan. And the president of Rio, Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva, will be making an appearance, I presume, towards the end of their presentation. Earlier on in the day, Chicago got up, and President Obama, of course, on a whirlwind visit here. He'll spend 5 hours in Copenhagen, the first of it in the presentation hall, where he was the climax to Chicago's presentation. A personal
here, Alex, plea. Let's listen to the president for just a moment, President Obama, and then we can sort of ask you how he did. Listen to this.
At the beginning of this new century, the nation that has been shaped by people from around the world wants a chance to inspire it once more, to ignite the spirit of possibility at the heart of the Olympic and Paralympic movement in a new generation, to offer a stage worthy of the extraordinary talent and dynamism offered by nations joined together, to host games that unite us in noble competition.
Well, later this afternoon, we're going to know if the Olympics is coming to the United States. Alex, how did President Obama do?
Well, this was Chicago's trump card. Of course, he said he wasn't going to go to or come to Copenhagen, changed his mind, and he made his presentation. It was 4 or 5 minutes. They went over their allotted time, actually, by 2 minutes, which won't go down well with some of the ISU members, but they weren't going to stop the President of the United States in full flow. And yes, as I said, it was a personal plea inviting the world to come to Chicago, Chicago, the town he calls home now. He met his wife there, and that's where they lived before they moved to Washington. I should say, actually, Michelle Obama gave a very emotional appeal to the IOC members just before her husband, and she talked about her father and how her father, despite being disabled with multiple sclerosis, had helped her get into sport and learn to throw a punch and kick a ball.
Well, emotional stuff, and everyone's pulling out all the stops. Alex Capstick, BBC Sports News correspondent, thanks so much. We will know the result later on today. Thanks so much. So we wanted to actually recreate the sense of the pitching here in the studio, and so we've asked Femi Oke to actually give us a sense of how people in both Rio and Chicago, which are believed to be the front running,
the top two, apparently, how
they are actually how they would pitch their cities if they could do it to us, and we're the IOC. What did you find?
Absolutely. So I went cold calling some bars in Chicago and Rio, and you find out how hospitable a city is
You're
calling them late at night when they're really, really busy.
Well, here's Neil, who you spoke to. He's a bartender at Sheffield's Beer and Wine Garden in Chicago.
One of the best cities in the country. You're not going to find better people. And definitely not going to find a more welcoming group who want the games here and are ready to open our doors to the international community and get people here in Chicago.
Have a listen out to Hanato Tejeda. He is a bartender at the Mariner Suites Hotel Bar in an upscale neighborhood in Rio.
On Friday, we're going to have a big party here because the results are going to come out on Friday, and people are going to make a party just to know the results. So we are willing to have the Olympic Games here. So 100%, I'm 100% sure that if we have the Olympic Games here, the world would never forget.
Very confident sounding.
Very, very confident. Not as confident, though, as Lucia Gamares. She is a journalist. She is based here in the U.S., but she was born in Rio. She's a Rio fanatic. Have a listen to her pitch.
Rio dances better, it cooks better, it smiles better. It treats foreigners much better. The cab drivers are reliable, adorable, amazing storytellers.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so the only person who's big enough to actually counteract Lucia as far as Rio and Chicago is concerned is the Chicago journalist. He's a syndicated columnist, Clarence Page. Take it away, Clarence.
What I really like in comparison to Rio is that in the summertime, we too have beautiful beaches and a lovely backdrop of skyscrapers, and you get all that and America too. So what more could you ask?
What more could you ask? I wonder what the IOC will be doing later on today. That's the people's pitch, John.
Well, you should email your pitch. Email that information to the
IOC. Do I have time? I'm going to text it.
But we should say the bookmakers are the ones who believe that Rio and Chicago are the top vote-getters
here. Odds.
I mean, it could go to Tokyo and Madrid. But let's move to Lynette Kalsnes, arts and culture reporter with WBEZ, public radio station in Chicago. Good morning, Lynette.
Good morning.
So I gather, and I used to live in Chicago, love the city. It would be a fabulous place for the Olympics. But I gather there are some people in Chicago who wish that it would be Rio, Madrid, or Tokyo, right?
That's indeed the case. The most recent poll has the support at, a little over 70%, but just sort of anecdotally talking to people, there are some folks who are concerned about the games coming here. They talk about the city's deficit, worried about getting stuck with the bill for this.
So tell us about one of the residents that you spoke with.
Yeah, I'm completely against it. I think it'll possibly displace a lot of people, or at least resources for people who are, don't have a voice necessarily to speak out against it.
How is it going to affect our way of life? And is it going to be worth it to live in the city? That bottom line is, I don't know if it's worth it in the long run.
Now, is that a real sort of politically valid statement, or are those just complainers?
The thing that's really interesting, of course, Chicago and Illinois have had some pretty well-publicized issues with corruption. Otto Miller would be one of the residents I talked to who's actually quite a big supporter of the games. He's hoping for jobs and economic development here.
Oh, well, I really hope they do come to Chicago. I have a lot of family in construction. Many of them are laid off now. So I think it'd give a boost to the local economy, maybe create some jobs.
And so the folks here, especially Anna Weinkraut, the first woman you heard from, really, I've heard a lot about the trust issue, that people are really concerned that between the corruption and a recent debacle we had over how parking meters were installed and the cost of them, people have some level of distrust. And
indeed,
I think that that is something we hear a lot.
Well, Chicago has Oprah. They can play that card. Lynette Kalsnes, arts and culture reporter at WBEZ. Thanks so much for that. Chicago, will it be the Olympic city in 2016? Got about 4 hours to learn it.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And you're about to enter, you know the place. It's the Twilight Zone.
And the journey into the shadows that we're about to watch could be our journey.
America entered Rod Serling's Twilight Zone 50 years ago today. Everyone knows about the zone, those iconic beeps, da-da-da-da, and even Rod Serling's distinctive voice warning us about a reality just out of reach. Even if you never saw the black and white, twisted, magnificent episodes, you know those things. There was the miserly, half-crazed, bookish Last Man on Earth episode, who believes he's in paradise.
Books! Books! All the books I'll need! All the books! All the books I'll ever want! Shelley, Shakespeare, Shaw!
Only to discover he's broken his only reading glasses.
That's not fair. That's not fair.
There was the woman who finds herself completely drop-dead gorgeous, but on a planet where our notion of beauty is the definition of hideous. So she basically drops dead.
Doctor, if I'm still terribly ugly, is there any other alternative?
I doubt very much whether we would be permitted to do anything but transfer you to a communal group of people with your disability.
All right, Miss Tyler, here comes the last of it.
There were the aliens who came to serve humanity.
Don't get on that ship! The rest of the book, To Serve Man, it's a cookbook!
Certainly one of my personal favorites, and lots of stories about terror in the skies.
Hold on a minute. Feel anything? Felt something. I can't put my finger on it. Yeah, maybe those jet streams are tricky. Is that crazy feeling I can't shake?
No, no, no. Nothing is ever quite right in Twilight Zone. That plane ended up millions of years back in time. And here is a young William Shatner whose career was launched by seeing a strange Bigfoot-like creature on the wing of his flying airliner.
There's a man out there. I don't mean a man. I mean, I don't know what I mean. I mean, maybe a... What do they call them during the war? Gremlins. I am not imagining it. Imagine it, he's out there.
Twilight Zone basically created the genre of creepy television with no special effects. It inhabited a domain of unreality in part because in the early 60s, actual political and social reality was sometimes hard to get on TV. So those monsters on Maple Street, they might be alien invaders from another planet, or those monsters might be the prejudice and fears of intolerant residents, a metaphor for racism.
If they want to look inside our house, let them get a search warrant.
Look, buddy, you can't afford to...
Now, Charlie, don't you tell me what I can afford. And stop telling me who's dangerous and who isn't, and who's safe and who's a menace.
And you're with them, too, all of you. You're all standing out here, all set to crucify somebody. You're all set to find a scapegoat. You're all desperate to point some kind of a finger at a neighbor.
The show was in the writing, a vehicle for short story writers and screenwriters who would cut their teeth on Twilight Zone scripts and move on to feature films. Five seasons and immortality, if not always commercial success. But virtually all of the sci-fi after Twilight Zone owes the series a debt. Outer Limits, The Invaders, even X-Files and Lost, with their creepy subtexts and plot twists, come directly from Rod Serling's world, a world very much still with us.
There's a man out there. Or a gremlin, or whatever. If I described him to you, you'd really think I was gone.
Oh, we're gone. Happy birthday, Twilight Zone. 50 years today. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, weekend movies. We're going to talk about that. And also, we have a weekend movie trivia question. Okay, here's the question. Go to our website, thetakeaway.org. Can you get this right? Name the director these actors all have in common. Mia Farrow, Shelley Winters, Adrian Brody and Jack Nicholson. If you know the director, write it at our website or go to myticketthetakeaway.org. Now, small businesses are bracing for dismal sales this holiday season. They may not be hiring. Are you depending on seasonal hiring for your holiday spending? Tell us if you're going to spend less, and if so, how much? Tell us at myticketthetakeaway.org. Right now, let's check top stories at 48 minutes after the hour. 9.8% of Americans are out of work. That's the latest unemployment number, which just came out a minute ago from the Labor Department. More than 250,000 people lost jobs last month. It's a bit worse than forecasters predicted, and it's moving the markets. Futures are way down this morning. President on the way home after making his pitch for Chicago to get the 2016 Summer Olympics. We'll find out who the city, what city it will be a little later today.
Rescuers in Western Indonesia believe nearly 3,000 people are still trapped in broken buildings after two earthquakes this week. They found a teen alive in the rubble earlier. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
All right. Good morning, everyone. If dinner and a movie are in your plans, you're on your own as far as the restaurant is concerned. We can help you out with the movies. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, is here in the studio. And also, we welcome back from our partner, The New York Times, A.O. Scott, the co-host of the award-winning TV show At the Movies. Congratulations for that.
Thank you.
And also film critic for The New York Times. So this weekend, we've got Zombieland is one of the blockbusters. Rafer, give us a sense of that movie. Can you give me like a four-worder on this one?
Yeah, sure. It's a coming-of-age movie set against the zombie apocalypse.
All right, let's hear a clip.
Planet Earth, home to over 6 billion people. Today, our very existence is threatened by epidemics, climate change, and dwindling resources. But those are the least of our problems. Welcome to Zombieland.
Sounds like our staff in the afternoon, yes. This feels like Inglourious Basterds meets Night of the Living Dead. What did you think?
It's almost a little bit more like, I would say more like John Hughes meets Night of the Living Dead.
Wow.
Jesse Eisenberg plays his usual, you know, sort of Asperger-ish teen misfit role, but he's very
good
at it.
Woody Harrelson is in this, right?
Big comeback for Woody, maybe?
What's that?
Big comeback for Woody Harrelson?
Big comeback. I mean, you know, he's great in it, actually. He's a lot of fun. You know, he mugs a lot, and which he's very good at. And, you know, it's him and Jesse Eisenberg, Emma Stone, Abigail Breslin. They form kind of a you know, makeshift family and traverse the landscape. And
it's a blockbuster combo, zombies and teenagers. Let's talk about Drew Barrymore releasing her directorial debut in Whippet. What did you make of this?
I actually really liked Whippet a lot. I thought it was really fun. It's got a nice girl power message to it.
Beauty Queen becomes roller derby champion.
That's right, Ellen Page. You know, sort of again redoing her Juno role a little bit, but she's very good. All the characters are good. Kristen Wiig from Saturday Night Live is in it. Drew Barrymore is also in it, and they make a really sweet team. The Hurl Scouts, by the way, is their roller derby name.
Is there a pregnancy subtext? Speaking of Juno,
there is not one.
So it's not completely the Juno role.
It's not total Juno.
All right, great. So we had Michael Moore on the program to talk about Capitalism, a Love Story. He was actually with us on Monday. That's his movie that goes wide this week. A.O. Scott, first of all, let's listen to a clip and get a comment.
Some guy, a steelworker, rises up out of his seat and just starts shouting at the screen, "Shame! Shame!" I mean, it's like, whoa. Well, good. Turn off the TV, you know, stop watching Dancing with the Stars, and get off the bench. Otherwise, we're going to lose what we have.
So that's the evangelist, Michael Moore, telling us that people in the seats were going crazy at the openings that he went to. Do you think they will?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think it had a very strong response. You know, it sold a lot of tickets in limited release. I think, in a way, this is the movie Michael Moore has been waiting 20 years to make since Roger and Me. I mean,
it's always been
the reality
capitalism.
Has sort of caught up with his point of view, and I think that there's more general receptiveness to his argument now than maybe there has been in the last 20 years.
Quickly, does that help the movie or hurt it?
I think it helps it. I think it helps it because I think that a lot of people who don't necessarily see themselves as his natural allies are you know, more open to what he has to say this time.
Okay, funniest man alive, of course, Ricky Gervais, correct?
Yeah.
I think so. The Invention of Lying is his movie. He's starring in it with Jennifer Garner. What do you make of this?
Well, it's a real mixed bag. There's some really, really funny stuff in it. At its high points, it's kind of high satirical points, it's hilarious. But then there's a kind of a romantic comedy thing that happens with Jennifer. He's not a great romantic lead.
What's the premise here?
The premise is that the world exists and no one has ever done anything but tell the truth. And Ricky Gervais, who plays a screenwriter, movies are actually filmed lectures on historical facts because no one can make anything up. He's a screenwriter. He one day just comes up with the idea that you could say something that isn't true. And as they say in the movie, everything changes.
He invents lying. Interesting.
Morning, Shelley.
Hi, Mark. I realize more and more every day how overqualified I am for this position and how incompetent you are at yours.
Any messages?
Anthony is coming up within the hour to see if he can get up the courage to fire you. If he can't, he said that he'll definitely do it tomorrow.
Anything else? Any messages not to do with being fired?
Well, I told everyone you're getting fired this week and they shouldn't expect their calls returned, so no one left any messages.
Okay.
That's Tina Fey, right?
Tina Fey as his assistant. And there's a lot of greats. Jeffrey Tambor is in it, Louis C.K. There's a small cameo by Philip Seymour Hoffman.
You can fall in love with the premise, but does it sustain?
Unfortunately, I think it doesn't. It reaches a peak, a high point where he invents religion, which everyone suddenly comes to believe in because nobody is capable of doubting anything.
So that's how it got started.
Yeah. He invents a man in the sky who makes all the rules and tells everybody how to live and becomes a big celebrity. Unfortunately, it's kind of undone by the need, which is not in Ricky Gervais's comfort zone, I think, to make it an affirming, sentimental love story about a schlubby guy who ends up with a beautiful woman.
So, Rafer and Tony, are you excited about this? Listen.
Cy and I think it's best if you move out of the house.
Move out?
Well, it makes eminent sense.
Things can't continue, as
move they? Out? Where would I go?
Oh, for instance, the Jolly Roger is quite livable. It's not expensive. The rooms are eminently habitable.
This would allow you to visit the kids.
There's convenience in its favor. You've got a pool.
Wouldn't it make more sense for you to move in with Cy?
Harry.
Larry, you are jesting.
It may sound like Curb Your Enthusiasm, but no, it's the Coen Brothers' new movie, Rafer.
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, it's one of these, you know, it's another comedy of cruelty from the Coen Brothers. You know, I mean, they do that very well. Yes, that's right. You know, they're taking a Jewish professor. It's set in 1967, and you know, essentially putting him through the ringer the way they do. You know, his wife is stepping out on him. His children barely acknowledge his existence. He's getting caught in a bribery scandal at the school.
This movie has to have the best trailer.
I think it's basically the Book of Job in the Minnesota suburbs in 1967.
Fabulous.
It's a comedy of cruelty, but I would say a comedy of divine or metaphysical cruelty.
All right, let's
just in time for the High Holy Days.
Let's do the trivia question before we go. Here we go. Can you get it right? What director do these actors all have in common? Shelley Winters, Jack Nicholson, Adrian Brody, and Mia Farrow. Call it out. Rafer?
I'm gonna say Roman Polanski.
Tony?
Yeah, I think so too. And I wonder if the Los Angeles District Attorney has called in with his answer.
You're right. It is Roman Polanski. Congrats to listeners Elizabeth Zimmer and Olivia Mollett, who emailed us the right answers, too. Can you get the movies they're from, though? Thanks so much to Rafer Guzman and A.O. Scott. Rafer Guzman, the film critic for Newsday. A.O. Scott, critic for our partner, The New York Times.
So you got to be wondering if the movie theaters are looking forward to good ticket sales over the holidays, because retailers are definitely not. We're hearing early reports that they're probably not going to be doing a lot of holiday hiring, which means for those of you who depend on those seasonal jobs in order to fund your purchases for Hanukkah or for Christmas, this could be a lean year. And we're wondering, are you planning to scale back your holiday spending? Liz emails us, "We're all gathering at my daughter's in Florida. The rule is no gifts except for the grandchildren. In the past, we exchanged stocking stuffers with the adults and real gifts with the kids. But this year, given the cost of travel, we've decided the real reason we do this is to be together and not to collect useful but not needed goodies." So tell us your story. If you're going to spend less these holidays, holidays by how much? Give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Obviously, if you've missed anything, we're always on here on The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes.
Do you know the movies?
Let me see.
Rosemary's Baby.
Chinatown. And The Tenant.
Nice. The Tenant.
I was racking my brain to figure out
the
Shelley Winters.
Very good. Celeste Headlee. What a champ.
And John Hockenberry.
This is The Takeaway. September's over and the Labor Department sings.
Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh so mellow.
The unemployment rate is approaching 10% here, and you know, new jobs reports are going to be coming out, and we're going to see continuing job loss even as the economy is beginning to stabilize.
Oh yeah, we learned just how mellow September was last hour. 263,000 workers less mellow. The latest unemployment rate is now 9.8%, and it's going to keep rising, the president predicted last summer. Maybe he's forgotten that prediction. Either way, we've got to follow the numbers. Following, it's what we do on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Follow nonsense. We're leaders. Good morning. It's Friday, October 2nd. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. So reports of hospital doctors treating patients in tents in parking lots out of Indonesia. We're going to take a look at relief efforts there after two powerful earthquakes. Also, the science behind them. And Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports guy, is going to tell you what to watch in the games this weekend.
But first, guess who nailed it this morning? Joining us now, once again, our friend Peter Morici. Peter is an economist and business professor at the University of Maryland. You nailed the unemployment rate at 9.8%. Does that mean something's happening in the economy that it's easier to predict these numbers?
No, in fact, I was dumb lucky. Even though the unemployment rate only went up as much as I said, we lost a lot more jobs than we expected. Yet why didn't unemployment pierce 10%? Quite frankly, a lot of people just quit looking.
Wow.
In Barack Obama's America, workers looking for work disappear every month.
People giving up. Peter, stay with us. Don't you give up. We'll be back in just a moment. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, hosting the Olympics would add jobs to Chicago's economy. The president is on his way home from Copenhagen. He told voters to have the 2016 Summer Games in the Windy City.
To host athletes and visitors from every corner of the globe is a high honor and a great responsibility. And America is ready and eager to assume that sacred trust.
We'll find out if International Olympic Committee voters agree in about 3.5 hours. In Washington, it took a marathon session, but the Senate Finance Committee has finished its health care bill. They wrapped up after 2 this morning, D.C. time. The committee holds a final vote on the bill next week.
CDC says it's concerned about H1N1 or swine flu deaths among pregnant women. Nearly 30 pregnant women have died since the outbreak. The CDC says H1N1 is now active in nearly every state. So the unemployment rate numbers that we talked about with Peter Morici just a moment ago is moving the market. 9.8% unemployment. Wall Street sank more than 2% yesterday. It opens at 95.09 this morning. The S&P starts trading at 10:30, and the Nasdaq begins at 20:57 in about 30 minutes' time. And futures trading suggests a negative opening when Wall Street gets underway. So small businesses are bracing for dismal sales and aren't expected to hire as many seasonal workers this holiday season. What does it mean for you? Are you dependent on a seasonal job for your holiday spending? If so, tell us how worried you are, if your options are narrowing, or if you're going to spend less this holiday season. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or post your thoughts at our website, thetakeaway.org. Good morning, everyone. Well, the headline is employers cut 263,000 jobs in September. That would be a long list of names if the Department of Labor published them that way.
Were we going to give all the names of everyone who lost their jobs, it would take up the whole New York Times, probably.
Yes, you know, but we should probably do that. If they did that, we might think about the statistic differently. I mean, we were sort of making light there of Peter Morici's prediction. He predicted 9.8% unemployment for September. That's what the Department of Labor said. said when we received the report just about 36 minutes ago. Peter Morici is still with us, economist and business professor at the University of Maryland. Peter, thanks for coming back. Let's just play and remind people what you said a couple of hours ago.
We will probably go to 9.8%, but it won't be long. Next month, the month after that, we'll go to 10%. The bad news is once we get there, we're going to hang there for a long time.
All right, Peter Morici, you described that as dumb luck at the top of the hour, and these 263,000 jobs cut in September are nothing to make light of. Why do you think so many workers have, as you say, given up and left the labor force, which actually moderates this number here?
Well, frankly, there's just no jobs out there to be found, and they're just flat-out discouraged. They run out of unemployment benefits. Once they do that, they don't need to look. There's no benefit to looking if there's nothing there. If you're in a two-income family and only one job has been lost, you can make it for a while. You can run down your assets a bit, things of that nature. People are just flat-out discouraged. Barack Obama's program is not working. I was looking at government employment. It's sinking all over the place. If he's saving school teachers' jobs, it's not in the numbers. But there was one bright spot.
Yeah.
The post office added people, more people to move fewer letters in a recession. That's your government stimulus package at work. They didn't get a nickel of the stimulus package, but there you go.
All right. Well, your former angst at Citigroup is now coming back to the Obama administration here, Peter Morici.
Well, I think they ought to take Vikram Pandit and put him in charge of employment, because at least they would have an excuse for this disastrous showing. They could say, well, we have an incompetent manager doing it. But instead, we're told they got the best and the brightest. Larry Summers, the golden child of Goldman Sachs, and Tim Geithner have got their eye on this, and nothing's happening.
All right. Well, we're going to ask you about the why of some of these statistics, but let's get into the names and the faces here in some of these unemployment statistics. Sandy Cole, office worker in Michigan, your name would be on that list of unemployed. You're part of the 9.8% figure, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
An unemployed office manager, correct?
Correct.
How long have you been out of work?
I was laid off in April.
In April. Now, why aren't you one of those discouraged workers who's given up, as Peter Morici suggests thousands and thousands of Americans have?
Well, I think part of it is I've got a drive that I'm more upbeat than some people. I'm trying to look at there are opportunities out there. I'm retraining. It's not what I really want to do, but I don't have a choice right now. And I'm trying not to sit around and feel sorry for myself, which would be real easy to do. But I do get discouraged. I mean, there is no question there. There are days I think, why am I even trying? Because there is no job.
Well,
but
Sandy,
hopefully I will.
Sandy, I love your drive. And the fact that you're retraining means that you're in classes with other workers who are trying to get different kinds of jobs. You're also applying for jobs, which means you're seeing other workers. What are they telling you? Are you seeing discouragement among the people that you're hanging around with trying to get back into the labor force?
Oh, yeah. There are so many people in class that are just totally discouraged. In fact, one girl yesterday said, why am I even trying? I don't think I'm going to go finish this class because there's not going to be a job there when I get done anyhow.
And that voice, that tone in your voice is exactly what's reflected in this monthly employment report. Correct, Peter Morici?
Absolutely. I mean, we're losing jobs just about everywhere, except the post office. I mean, we're even losing jobs at state and local governments. And, the president beat the drum how he was going to save the policemen's jobs and the school teachers' jobs and so on and so forth. It's just not happening. They've got all this money in Washington, and they can't seem to get it out to the states. They can't get construction spending going. I was examining those numbers this morning, and basically residential construction's picked up a little bit. Government construction continues to plummet. I mean, the president has an execution problem.
All right.
Can't get the money out.
Well, let's again get into the why. Maybe there's a bright spot in the sense that some of that money is going to come down the pike in the next couple of months.
I'm very hopeful.
Well, hold on a second, Peter, because we have Michael Powell on the line. He's the founder and president of Powell's Books. He is employed, yet I'm wondering if anything that you're hearing this morning makes you a little nervous about heading into the holiday season. You're a retailer. You need credit. You have to hire workers. What's the state of your business right now, Michael Powell?
Well, I'm a little worried about those numbers. It wasn't just the 9.8, but it was the 17% that were underemployed, either dropped out or were taking temporary jobs. And that's a pretty big number. We saw a good September. We're going to watch October and early November and make some decisions. We're doing some light hiring, I would call it. We're probably going to hire somewhere around a third to a half of what we normally do for the holidays. But I refuse to, you know, say it's going to be a terrible holiday season. We had a snowstorm last year, and we had a terrible holiday season, so it's not going to be hard to beat those numbers.
Different kind of storm this year.
Weather can dispose as much as the economy.
Sure. Now, but Powell's Books is one of the most famous independent bookstores in the United States. A lot of our listeners, I think, are familiar with it. And economic statistics are available in your sort of business numbers, but also in the way people are coming to your store. Do you see people buying more books on retraining, self-help, DIY, people who are trying to shift careers? Is that affecting your business at all?
Oh, yeah. We see a lot on manuals on taking exams and starting businesses and retraining, and certainly you see a lot of interest in that area. We're selling more books than we did a year ago. We're just selling cheaper books, and that, you know, people are moving to value. They're moving to lower price goods, used books. So I don't see a fall off on activity. Or it's just that, unfortunately, it's they're walking away from the hardback new book.
You know, we also heard some pretty interesting things from Target, Michael Powell of Powell's Books in Oregon, where they were talking about they're not only going to be hiring fewer people over the holidays, but they've started really cross-training people to do multiple jobs, so that's one way they can keep from having to hire more people. They can have the same person doing three or four things. Are you maybe saying, I mean, I know you're specialized, but are you doing that kind of thing in your own business as well?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when you need the cashiers, you want to have a pool of them ready, and so cross-training is very important. The other thing we're doing is we're looking to IT for more and more solutions. As this has gotten difficult, we've looked at all our processes and said, you know, what can we do here with automation that would help us so that we don't have to rebuild those numbers, employment numbers, as rapidly as we historically have. And if every company in America is doing that, that's obviously going to have an impact on hiring.
Well, positive to the bottom line, but definitely also having an impact on that unemployment number. Michael Powell, founder and president of Powell Books, thanks so much for being our companion here this morning as we try to get behind the numbers on unemployment rate. And Sandy Cole, unemployed office manager in Michigan from your home, you know, good luck today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, Sandy and Michael, thanks so much. Peter Maurizi, let's go out with you now. You hear the voices there. You feel the tone of discouragement among these people. When are we going to start seeing some of the federal money that Barack Obama has promised reflected in these numbers? And you just said a couple of minutes ago that residential construction should be moving upward because of stimulus money, but it's not.
Well, residential construction is moving upward because people are buying houses with regard to that $8,000 credit. So that's not stimulus.
It's the federal tax credit.
Right, that's good. Right. That's good. But in terms of that $760 billion, my feeling is we're going to finally start to see that flowing earnestly enough to have an impact in the first quarter of next year. Mm-hmm. Unemployment will top out around, you know, 10.1, 10.2, 10.3, and it'll stay there. But that will mean, for it to stay put, it'll mean we'll start having a net gain of jobs of 100,000, 150,000, that sort of thing.
Whether
the rate moves up or down,
or
down is not significant, but we'll start to gain some jobs again.
What's the chance? I mean, you were very cynical about the Obama administration a few minutes ago. What is the chance that Larry Summers and Barack Obama sat around and said, no, we have to stagger this, we have to do it slowly so that it hits in the first quarter of next year, that this is all part of the plan?
I don't think that's the case at all. And I'm not cynical. I'm skeptical. I don't think they have a handle on it. I just don't. The things they say, the numbers they put out are unrealistic. My feeling is they're having execution problems within the bureaucracy, which is more than economic policy. They're having trouble getting the bulldozers going. You know, it's very hard to spend new money in Washington these days because we have so many checks and balances. This inspector general system, I mean, you can't spend 25 cents of new money without the inspector general coming down on your back and finding you guilty of some kind of fraud. The TARP money was a classic example. We know where the TARP money went. We know where it was used. It's coming back. There was nothing really wrong.
Hmm. Well, the moving the levers of cash into the economy are much more difficult to do. Moving those levers is much more difficult to do than it was during FDR's time, that's for sure. Peter Maurizi describing
even
that for
Kennedy's
us.
Even Jack Kennedy's time.
Even Jack Kennedy's time. 9.8% unemployment, that's the headline. 263,000 workers lost from the payrolls in September. Peter Maurizi, economist and business affairs professor at the University of Maryland. Thanks as always.
All best.
And now some quick takeouts on stories we have to be on top of this week. We'll start with Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. So healthcare reform, some major developments earlier this morning. But it seems to me in general, Todd, that healthcare reform has really tested the patience, the wonkiness, as well as the manners of lawmakers this week. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, the patient. I mean, you know, John, this is what we pay him for. Late nights, you know, what are we dealing with? 17% of the economy. They better be willing to stay up late.
I'm all
committee,
for it.
Yeah, well, the committee finished this bill, finished the amendments on this bill at about 2:15 this morning.
Senate Finance Committee.
Senate Finance Committee, getting this bill ready to go to the floor. Now, they got to vote on it next week, as you mentioned, in the committee. But they made some fairly major progress on the affordability front. You know, one of the major issues with this bill is we want to get everyone signed up for insurance, or almost everyone, and but we have to make it affordable. So you have the individual mandate. Everybody has to buy coverage.
Right.
And if you don't buy coverage, you get penalized. Well, the problem with that is people who don't have a lot of money, if you penalize them or make them buy insurance, can they afford it? So there was a major amendment last night sponsored by Chuck Schumer that basically exempted about 2 million people from having to buy coverage, and that's supposed to make the coverage more affordable. It's a fairly major step because it makes the bill potentially more palatable to people like Olympia Snow, the only Republican right. who might vote for this.
I mean, quickly, they could have gotten down the subsidy road to make it more affordable that way, but instead they just exempt people. What about the manners? Some pretty nasty tempers there in Congress this week.
Yeah, you know, we got to open the sideshow file a little bit, I guess, on a Friday. Alan Grayson of Florida, of course, got on the floor. Many people might have heard about this and said the Republican health plan is don't get sick, and if you get sick, die fast. The Republicans want you to die quickly, and there's a holocaust of health care that Republicans basically like. They went nuts. Speaker Pelosi got asked yesterday whether this Democrat should be reprimanded or whether he should apologize. She said, no. I didn't like his words, but if he's going to apologize, everyone should apologize. Of course, she was referring to who? Joe Wilson.
Right,
remember
of
him?
Course. Yes, yeah. The Eli man. Yeah.
So another week, another bit of ignominy on the House floor. He didn't break any rules with his comments. He didn't disparage any individual members or the president. But it wasn't appropriate. So Republicans are mad about it. But it's a sideshow, you know. As
and
the it
will
debate
probably stay
up.
That way. Yep.
Yeah, exactly right. But yeah, tempers flare with a big issue like this.
All right. So next week, healthcare vote in the Finance Committee, and then it goes on to the full Senate. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Now to Louise Story, the finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Louise, things happening in the entertainment business. What's going on with NBC?
Well, there's talk that Comcast, the giant cable company, may buy it from General Electric. And it's pretty interesting for a number of reasons. One is that, you know, NBC has always been sort of a misfit within GE because they mostly own industrial companies. But the other reason is that it would make Comcast such a giant in the media industry. And you have to think about why they're doing this. And part of the reason is the internet. Because think about how much TV you're watching, not on your cable box, but on your computer. And NBC has been doing a big growth online with digital media.
So we've seen HBO develop into a major TV and movie producer. Is Comcast going to start getting into the programming business?
Well, if they owned, you know, USA and CNBC and NBC, which they would get here, as well as the Universal movie unit, then yeah, they'd be in it, and it kind of fulfills an ambition Comcast has had. Remember, about 5 years ago, they tried to buy the Walt Disney Company, major entertainment unit, and so it's kind of a bit of deja vu for them in terms of their ambition.
But Comcast has denied this so far, this deal.
Well, they put a statement out yesterday that they were not looking. You know, sources that are talking to the New York Times say that they are. They issued an email to their employees yesterday saying that they're always considering acquisitions that they believe are good opportunities. So it's a little hazy, but my colleagues at the New York Times have, you know, reported that these discussions are going on.
Okay, and also Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke testified before the Financial Services Committee. Quickly, did he have anything major to say?
Well, we're seeing the Fed backtrack a little. Earlier in the year, some people in the administration were saying the Fed would have this uber regulator role, kind of like Zeus on high that can just zap down a lightning bolt anywhere in the markets. And yesterday, Bernanke said, look, we'll just take on the most important systemic institutions. And as for that Uber regulator, we're happy to pass it off to a council. So that was, you know, a smaller role for the Fed than some people had been envisioning. And it might reflect the reality that the Fed has been getting a lot of political pushback.
He also said we could be back inside a crisis in a few years or so.
Oh,
Louis,
yeah.
Story.
Well, whatever, whatever finance... he said, the markets hated it.
That's right. Finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks, Louise.
So it's week four in the NFL season, and we'll get a takeout from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Looking forward at the NFL matchups this weekend. What's on tap, and what do you like?
So obviously the game of the week is the New Orleans Saints against the New York Jets in their high-powered offense led by Drew Brees.
Brees steps up down the middle. Colston with a catch and a touchdown.
Ooh. Drew Brees will pick you apart. He's going for the back of the end zone. Shockey is back there. He hung on. Touchdown.
Play action from Brees. Touchdown, Heath Evans.
Play action. Brees with time. Looks deep. Throws deep. Into the end zone. Meacham. Touchdown.
He's just a broken record, Brees. Brees, yeah.
Yeah.
This is a real test of the Jets so far. Decent-looking defense.
Definitely, but I think Brees is hands-down the best player in the NFL right now. He's leading an offense that has averaged 40 points a game in the season. He's thrown nine touchdowns, nine of those touchdowns, at a blistering pace. So many weapons. Even the running game is ranked 2 in the league, and he's going to go up against the New York Jets, who have the number 3 defense in the league. And according to ESPN, they pressure and blitz the quarterback on 62% of their plays.
Wow.
So there's an old adage that says offense wins games and defense wins championships. Well, my guess here is look for the Jets to get in the hole early. They're going to claw their way back with their defense, and the question is who's going to respond to pressure the best.
By the end, the Jets hope that Brees will be so rattled that they'll be able to get the edge in the fourth quarter.
Perhaps. And then the other side of the ball, the New Orleans defense is led by this guy, Darren Sharper, who has 3 picks, and I played against him in college at the University of Rhode Island. So Darren Sharper has 3
this
picks.
This is your life. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
And the question is, at the end of the game, when the Jets really have to step up and score, because the New Orleans Saints probably will score a lot of points, will Mark Sanchez be able to control himself and not get...
It's a test of the rookie at the Jets. Okay, 3 other matchups quickly.
So you have the Baltimore Ravens against the New England Patriots. That's a great game right there. Also, the Dallas Cowboys are going to be going into Denver, and I think Dallas is going to do good because they're going to be out of their stadium for the first time.
They need to, yeah.
And then also you have... what you look for in the NFL is how teams improve from week to week. So the San Diego Chargers need to improve, and the Pittsburgh Steelers need to improve.
Yeah, they sure do. After that drubbing, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, looking forward to the NFL matchups in the fourth week of the NFL season. Coming up, we'll check in on the latest on Indonesia, where earthquakes killed more than 1,100 people. We'll see how aid organizations are helping and take a look at some geology. That's in a few minutes.
Good morning.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the urgent needs for aid by those affected by the quakes in Indonesia in a moment. Right now, let's check the leading stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Big news on the economy this morning. The unemployment rate is now up to 9.8%. More than 250,000 people lost their jobs this month. That's worse than forecasters predicted. And in Washington, Finance Committee senators have finished work on a health care overhaul bill. Work went past 2 o'clock this morning. Next week, senators are expected to vote it out of committee and into the full Senate.
In other health news, the CDC is sounding the alarm about pregnant women and H1N1 or swine flu. Nearly 30 have died since the flu outbreak started. David Letterman says someone wanted $2 million to keep quiet about his affairs with women working on his show. He admitted the relationships on his program last night. Letterman says he told authorities, and a CBS employee is now charged in the plot. And the world is waiting to hear who will host the 2016 Summer Games. The IOC voters will choose among Chicago, Rio, Madrid, and Tokyo later today. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Okay, more than 700 people confirmed dead, more than 2,000 hospitalized in Indonesia. Indonesia's health ministry says nearly 3,000 people may still be trapped under rubble there. We're talking this morning with Bill Horan, the president of Operation Blessing International, about the earthquake that hit the country 2 days ago. Bill, you're joining us from Virginia Beach, but you have relief workers in Indonesia. What are they seeing there?
We do. We have an office and infrastructure in Jakarta, as well as several other offices throughout Indonesia where we conduct daily operations. And so we were able to respond immediately. Yesterday, we had 2 medical teams on the ground. Today, we have 4 teams consisting of doctors and nurses that we flew in. We also have relief on the way by sea on a Navy vessel, and also we've got a small convoy of trucks on the way up there. But what our folks on the ground are reporting is incredible destruction and devastation. And they are telling me that it's much worse than is currently being reported on the media, mainly because the media seems to be focused on Padang, which is the capital and the big city there. But there are outlying communities that they are telling me are completely just destroyed. And so I'm afraid that this is going to follow the trend that we saw in the great tsunami, where the first day or two, everyone knew it was bad, but every day it just got exponentially worse. So we expect this is probably going to be a really horrible thing for some weeks to come.
Well, this is a report from an AP correspondent talking about earthquake rescue teams, Anthony Deutsch talking about them in Jakarta.
One report that I got was that last night surgeons were trying to operate on people pulled out of the rubble using the lights from the car headlights.
We also have reports of hospital workers putting people into tents in a parking lot. Is this the kind of things that you're seeing from relief workers?
Yeah, definitely. In Padang, there are at least one and possibly two hospitals that evidently have just fallen in on themselves. There's no power in the city. Our teams travel with small generators, so we can generate power enough, at least for lights and that sort of thing. We've got a whole bunch of generators being shipped in on an Indonesian Navy vessel, which will arrive Sunday, either Saturday night or Sunday morning. But access is very difficult because the infrastructure, roads are broken, bridges are out, but we face those same sorts of challenges during the big tsunami, and have gotten pretty good at being able to move nimbly. But yes, we're seeing exactly that same situation.
Well, Indonesia's health ministry says nearly 3,000 people could be trapped under rubble, but you're saying if you include some of these smaller cities, it could rise even higher than that. Is there enough international aid and governmental aid in Indonesia right now to cope with this disaster?
No, certainly not. Since it happened such a short time ago, there's been hardly time for folks to mobilize. The NGOs, non-government organizations that have infrastructure in Indonesia, like ourselves, we've been there since 1998, we can respond very quickly. But if you're, for example, a U.S.-based organization and you had a heart to help over there, it's going to take some time for you to get people on the ground. You know, we wire money from Virginia Beach to our office in Jakarta so that they can immediately buy the sorts of things that they need. Our initial focus is medical, and so that's why we've launched these medical teams. And that's the same thing we did in the tsunami. We were operating 22 clinics at one time in the field. And so the medical needs and the food and water needs, of course, are the most urgent. And there's certainly not enough help there, and they need a whole bunch of help.
Okay, Bill Horan is the president of Operation Blessing International, nonprofit relief organization. Good luck to you and your workers, Bill.
Thank you very much, Les.
So, as I said before, the list of places hit by earthquakes this week is relatively long. Sumatra twice, Samoa once, California and Peru. Is there any correlation between all of these earthquakes? To get that answer, we have geophysicist Amy Vaughn, an analyst at the United States Geological Survey, the National Earthquake Information Center. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
So I guess that's the first question here. I can't imagine there's such thing as an earthquake season, right?
We really don't have seasons as such. What we have is that seismically active areas are just prone to go off whenever they feel like it, for lack of a better word. And really, we have statistics which show we can expect a certain number of larger events, and we just happen to get two fairly close together right now, but they really do happen year-round. It's just a matter of timing in this case, I think.
Well, some of these earthquakes are long distance apart. I mean, obviously, the tsunami that was caused by an earthquake near Samoa is a long way from Indonesia, and yet you have to wonder, at some point, do these fault lines connect somewhere?
Really, they don't. They're fairly distinct plate boundaries, which have a series of fault lines within those regions. So it's not safe to say, though, that those two are interconnected, whereas in Indonesia, the two earthquakes that happened there are just a few fault lines apart, whereas the fault lines that occurred between Samoa and Indonesia are, you know, we're talking distance approximately Alaska to Florida for
wow.
just kind of perspective.
So, Amy, talking about the Indonesian fault issues there, is there a cycle in the seismic activity in that part of the world? I mean, the proximity there is maybe a little more alarming.
We really, I mean, the ones in Indonesia, those are very statistically common, actually. There's a number of sixes that can happen in any given year, and, of course, that's one of the most seismically active areas of in the world. And, again, this does happen year-round. It just happens that these are more newsworthy because of the higher magnitude and the damages and fatalities. And then coupled with both events happening within 24 hours, it makes it just all that more interesting to people, I think. And the speculation is, of course, I think understandable, based on that.
Amy Vaughn, geophysicist, is an earthquake 1 year like we had before? Does that make it more probable the next year?
Actually, these are pretty probable in general. Typically, okay. we have statistics kind of going back historically that show that there's usually only one event in a given year that is 8.0 or higher. And sometimes, okay. of course, there's a few more. We've had that happen.
Amy Vaughn is a geophysicist with the USGS joining us from Colorado. Well, John, this morning we've been talking a lot about unemployment, and one of the statistics out there is that there's probably not going to be a lot of hiring over the holidays. If you are one of our listeners and you depend on seasonal work to help you through the holidays, let us know how you're going to cope at mytakeofthetakeaway.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Last night, David Letterman had a startling admission to his audience that he was having sexual relationships with female staff members and that he was being extorted for it.
I feel like I need to protect these people. I need to certainly protect my family. I need to protect myself, hope to protect my job.
Authorities have arrested a suspect for the alleged blackmail scheme. They haven't released the name. The AP is reporting, though, that the suspect is Robert Halderman, a producer on CBS's show 48 Hours. So does any of this matter to you? And is this going to make you want to tune in more to the David Letterman show? Our friend Delana Dixon joins us now. She's a TV critic on the blog site DelanaDixon.com. Good morning, Delana.
Good morning.
So were you surprised that David Letterman chose to make these admissions on his own show?
It was pretty shocking that he chose to do it on his show, but it was a really smart move. In the end, David Letterman has to worry about his biggest audience, which is his audience. If they accept that he's done this and they're okay with it, then he'll probably be able to keep his job, unless we find out that it was a case of sexual harassment, which takes it to a whole nother legal level.
So that would be why he wouldn't decide to go ahead and do this in an emotional interview on Larry King, right?
Well, I think his idea was, since he was actually down talking to the police the day that it happened, it was going to get out there. So instead of waiting and letting the tabloids have their chance to talk about what was going to happen, he got out there first. He told his side of the story. So anybody moving forward, of course, they'll be exploring it. But he was the first one who could kind of set the tone that he wanted the story to take.
You know, it also tells a story of the seamy side of some of these, you know, doc shows. A 48 Hours employee was arrested, is behind this whole thing. The details are pretty spooky.
Yeah, it's kind of that one of his colleagues at CBS is actually going to take it out on him. You're thinking kind of, okay, what kind of salaries are they getting over there? But, they have a lot of inside information, and it's scary that somebody so close to you would use it against you.
But as you kind of mentioned in terms of harassment, it's not really one of his colleagues. He owns Worldwide Pants, at least, and to a certain extent, he's kind of in a boss relationship here. Not necessarily of, 48 Hours, but he's certainly probably above this person, right?
David Letterman or the...
David Letterman?
I would think that David Letterman is probably on the equal level with this guy.
Right.
So it's kind of a case of, it just seems strange that a producer would decide to take this route and put his own job in jeopardy, because obviously he's not going to be working for CBS.
Yeah, he's nailed. I guess, the big question is, what's Leno going to do to top this, huh?
Well, what's interesting is Leno makes a living kind of probing celebrities on their awkward moments. So moving forward, how exactly is he going to handle it when someone comes on his stage and has to deal with something that's personally awkward? Is he going to be sympathetic to them? Is he going to be empathic? Or is he going to have to be a little less you know, dealing with it in a situation since he has to deal with his own.
I guess the big question, Delaina Dixon, is this, could this get worse? I mean, depending on who these women were that he had these relationships with and what they have to say, right?
Well, it was interesting on his show last night. He said that he wanted to protect the women, he wanted to protect his family, and he wanted to protect himself. Whether they decide to come forward at this point is their own business. But I think in the end, the biggest person he's going to have to answer to is his wife, Regina Lasko, because obviously he's been with her for 20 years. So this obviously took place while he was with her.
They've only been married since March, though.
Yeah, they've only been married, but they've actually been together for 20 years.
Okay.
So that meant that it took place while he was with her. So morally, whether it was right or wrong, he's going to have to answer to her.
Okay, Delaina Dixon, a blogger on the site, DelainaDixon.com. I'm sure we'll hear more about this.
Good morning, I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, you're going to meet a man who literally tilts at windmills, but he's no Don Quixote, no sir. That's in just a moment. But right now, let's check out some of the top stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Unemployment up again. New numbers just out this morning show the rate at 9.8%, the highest in more than a quarter century. If Chicago wins its bid to host the 2016 Summer Olympics, it could add jobs there. The IOC announces its decision today at 12:30 Eastern Time.
Stick a fork in it. The Senate Finance Committee health bill done. Work wrapped up very early this morning. The committee votes on it next week. And David Letterman, as we said, revealed on his show last night he had affairs with employees. He said someone's trying to blackmail him for $2 million to keep that quiet. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
So Steve Erlanger now rejoins us. He's the Paris bureau chief for our partner, the New York Times, to talk about the U.S. and Iran nuclear talk. Steve Erlanger, how unexpected was this apparent Iranian cooperative attitude to allow inspectors as these talks conclude?
I think they were compelled to open the Qum facility. They announced it to the IAEA simply, within minutes of finding out that the United States and its allies had revealed it to the IAEA. So if it's going to stay, at least notionally, within its deal with the IAEA, it had to open it up to inspections. What the Americans and others wanted was a rapid inspection before things could be moved around. And the head of the IAEA, Mohammed Al-Bardeh, is due in Tehran this weekend to talk about timing. So the two-week thing was new, and it's a bit of a deadline.
Right. But we are seeing sort of outlines of compromise and counterproposals that at least suggest these talks could go on for a while.
Yes, I think they can. I mean, there's already another meeting scheduled somewhere before the end of October. And probably most interesting thing that came out of this was an Iranian agreement in principle to move a lot of its low-enriched uranium made at its plant in Natanz out to Russia and then France to be fabricated into fuel for a small Tehran reactor that makes medical isotopes. That's a reactor that's well supervised. And the idea of taking out a lot of this low-enriched uranium, if it works, should calm tensions.
Very interesting. So, Steve Erlanger, I can't resist. You're on the train between Geneva and Paris. How fast are you going?
Well, we just left the station, but I guess we're going probably about 100 miles an hour.
Nice. Steve Erlanger, Paris bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, covering those Iranian talks on Iranian nuclear programs. So here we have a story now about a very simple idea and how it can change the world like magic.
5 years ago, you had an idea. What was that?
I want to make a windmill.
A windmill?
Yeah. After I dropped out from school, I went to library, and I read a book titled Using Energy, and I get information about windmill, and I try, and I made it.
That is a young boy, William Kakwamba, in halting English, delivering a talk at the prestigious TED Conference back in 2007, a room full of high-tech wizards listening to the story of a homemade windmill and a young man a long, long way from home.
Before that time, I had never been away from my home in Malawi. I had never used the computer. I had never seen an internet. I had never been surrounded by so many Azungu white people.
Well, William Kamkwamba is meeting a lot of Azungu these days. He's traveling the world because of this book. Out this week, The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind. It tells the story of how in 2002, as a teenager in the very poor African nation of Malawi, William had a vision of how a little generator on a bicycle that powered a bike light, if it was somehow connected to a windmill, could actually allow him to study his school books at night. But even more dramatically than that, he could see how such a windmill might actually bring the 20th century to his own village. Here's how he described it to us when he stopped by our studios.
Seeing the picture of the windmill on the book say that the windmill could pump water and generate electricity. No, pump water meant irrigation, a defense against hunger. And I said to myself that this is what I need to solve this problem.
And it was a journalist named Brian Mueller who found William and watched his crazy attempt to build a windmill generator out of junk laying around his impoverished village.
For his blades, he had gotten PVC pipe from a bathhouse.
Plastic pipes.
Plastic pipes, and he had cut them down the middle with a bow saw and then melted them over a fire. And as before they could cool, he flattened them down and then using the bow saw, carved them into his blades.
Kind of ironed plastic to be flat.
So together, Brian Mueller and William Kamkwamba collaborated to write The Boy Who Harnessed the Wind, which tells a rich story of low-tech genius and self-determination in a nation, Malawi, that would defeat the most determined of entrepreneurs.
It's one of the poorest countries in Africa. It's very densely populated. And people are sustenance farmers, and basically they make enough money each year. They sell a bit of maize, or they have a little bit of tobacco. And so they have a little bit of money, and the only money they have, they use it to buy seed and a little bit of fertilizer if they're lucky.
But for William Kamkwamba, poverty became his ally. The cast-off pieces of junk that he found all around him were his natural resources, the nuts and bolts of an idea that his neighbors thought was crazy. Misala, they called him. Brian Mueller says being called crazy didn't stop William at all.
And so, you know, William, you had all these pieces, and you know, he didn't have washers, and so he would go collect bottle caps, beer bottle caps, in front of the bar and flatten them out and put a hole through the middle. He didn't have a drill, so he would use a nail heated over his mom's cooking fire that he would bore holes through this plastic. And then his cousin found a car battery, so he was able to hook the windmill up to a car battery, charge it, and then power four more bulbs. Which he ran through a circuit breaker system that he made out of nails and wire and a magnet that he busted off of a stereo speaker. And it worked.
It worked. I love this part. Here's William telling me what it felt like the moment that he turned on his village's first light bulb.
I have been working for a long time, and people have been mocking me. And it was like I'm trying to prove to people that what I was doing, it wasn't craziness, but it was something useful. So I kept looking at it and then smiling all the time, saying that, no, now I think I'm released from people saying that I'm craziness, yeah.
And so William Kamkwamba's craziness became light. Journalist Brian Mueller saw those lights come on and the reaction in the village.
Well, immediately he had a line of people to the down the road to charge their mobile phones. And so you couldn't really get rid of them, William. I mean, and he even made a little light, an outlet that was that you could plug in your mobile phone outside of his house. And so and then people, I guess, began to believe him. But then for 4 years, he sort of just had this windmill, and people would come, and he was, you described it to me so beautifully how you felt like a reggae star. You had this hit album, and so your fans were expecting the next record.
The sequel, right?
Yeah, and so William began another series of experiments.
William Kamkwamba learned a lot from his little projects, including the perils of confronting the central government in Malawi, which wants to be the one to control electricity in all the villages. And William attracted the attention of venture capitalists and other allies and is now studying hard to become a scientist or an engineer at a university in South Africa. Whatever he accomplishes, it will be hard to top the story of that boy who harnessed the wind.
I'd like to say something to all the people out there, like me, to the Africans and the poor who are struggling with your dreams. God bless. I say to you, trust yourself. And believe, whatever happened, don't give it up. Thank you.
William Kakwamba is showing off his personal magic, telling his story, hoping to inspire others here in Oxford, England last year. He says the magic is that it's not magic. You just need one determined person to change the world.
It's a truly amazing story, John.
It's a great kid. It's a great kid.
Great book, yeah. Also.
Indeed. A fabulous story. It really is a good read.
So we're talking all day about unemployment and holiday unemployment, especially. Retailers, Target and others saying they're probably not going to hire that many people over the holidays. And we're wondering if you're one of the people that depends on seasonal employment to help you fund your holiday purchases, how is this going to affect you? Are you going to tighten your belt? How are you going to make it through the holidays? Email us at mytakeofthetakeaway.org or post a message to our site at the takeaway.
What's going on that site, by the way?
What's going on? Well, yeah. People are talking, actually.
Really?
We got
people
a message
go
from
to it?
Yeah, Dessert Girl writes that the Obama's trip to Copenhagen to talk about the Chicago and the Olympics was a self-serving waste of taxpayer money, she says. Obama is not the mayor of Chicago, and if he and Michelle want to go to Copenhagen, Chicago should pay all their expenses, or they should pay for them themselves. It's an interesting point. What's your take on any of this? Tell us at thetakeaway.org. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast. That's at thetakeaway.org.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Have a wonderful weekend, folks.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.